My name is Frances Crook and I'm the Chief Executive of the Howardly for Penal Reform, and I'm very pleased to welcome you here to this joint event with LSE Mannheim Centre. It's part of a series of discussions we've been having over the past couple of years with some of the most eminent thinkers across the criminal justice and broader fields, political as well. We had Professor Robert Reiner, Dennis O'Connor and Baroness Hamwee talking about policing. We had John Fassenfeld, Professor Barry Godfrey, and Professor Julian Roberts, and me, talking about the magistrates. We had Professor... There's a lot of professors here. I may just leave that aside for a moment. Andrew Ashworth, Lord Faulkner, and Keir Starmer, talking about property offences and imprisonment. We had Tapio Lappi Sipala. I'm really proud I can say that. He's lovely. And Baroness Nora O'Neill and Richard Wilkinson and Coretta Phillips talking about what makes why some countries deal with a much smaller prison population than others. And so we have a really eminent cohort of people contributing. And yesterday I was at an event in the House of Commons, which was a parliamentary launch of a publication from an earlier, from one of our What If seminars, which was Jonathan Shepherd's seminar talking about the future of probation and how there ought to be an academic basis, a scientific and academic basis for probation. And they're recommending there should be some kind of an academic institute. And he suggested this a year ago. And yesterday, the day that we had the parliamentary launch of his publication, the Ministry of Justice announced that they were going to have an institute for probation. So not only do we think, we also influence if things happen. I have to say it's not quite what we had in mind, but the Ministry of Justice never gets it quite right. But they are at least moving in the right direction. And it will take time to set up an institute. But it's a good start, and we're very pleased. You will find in your packs, or in they've been given to you, membership forms and copies of previous publications. I am never allowed to leave an audience without making it very clear that we are a charity and a voluntary organisation, and the membership form is actually compulsory to fill in before you leave the room, because we rely on your support in order to be influential and make change. So, I've got a fantastic panel. They are sitting in the audience, so they can have a look at the slides. Peter Nerud was the Chief Constable in Thames Valley, and I've known Peter for nearly 30 years, I think, on and off.
Yes, it is.
He doesn't look a day older than he did when I met him. He was the Chief Executive of the National Policing Improvement Agency, retiring in 2010, and is currently regressing by going back to being a student and doing a PhD at Cambridge. We have Professor Gloria Laycock, who worked in the Home Office, researching policing and crime, and became the founding director of the Jill Dando Institute of Crime Science at UCL. And we have Paul Ekblom, who was a researcher at the Home Office focusing on crime prevention, evaluation of the Safer Cities programme, particularly on burglary, and is now a visiting professor at Huddersfield and associate of the Jill Dando Institute of Crime Science. So you will see a very eminent and interesting collection of people. What's going to happen is that Peter is going to speak for about half an hour. Our discussants will then respond for about a quarter of an hour each. Peter will then be given a chance to respond to them briefly, and then I'll open it up to you to make comments and questions. There is a roving mic, and we will do that. And I just hope we have a really interesting evening. I was talking to Peter before we came in here, and so much of the criminal justice system is based on emotion, not science, and I think it's about time that we introduced a little bit of rigour and scientific thought into the penal system, because for the last 1,000 years or so, being emotional hasn't really got us very far, and we need to change. So I'm really interested in what he's going to say. Yes, Peter.
Okay. So, this is going to be a bit of a gallop, because there's a lot in this piece of research. It's ironically, this is not what I'm writing my PhD on, okay? It just happens to be the research program that I'm running. So it's the bigger piece. I'm actually doing a PhD which is looking at how to conduct experiments in policing and in this territory, because actually running this experiment has been, how shall I put it, eye-opening, as I thought it might be. Rather more eye-opening than I had envisaged at the start, though. I'm going to focus on the gateway to the system, which may seem a very obvious place to focus in the system, but is not a place there where a lot of the really good research has focused. It has tended to focus either way before that, i.e. place-based policing, a lot of the randomised control trials are well before you get to the court system, or well after, when you're randomising various forms of rehabilitation and treatment. There has been very little work in the gateway. What I'm going to do is talk about a what-if. It's a deliberate what-if and a provocative what-if about what if we really change the way we do the gateway. So those are the headers. And it kind of starts off, so why does the gateway matter? There is a fairly comprehensive systematic review that's just been updated by Anthony Petrosino that looked at the gateway as far as juveniles are concerned. Most of these studies are American studies. There have been precious few, as you'll see, precious few UK-based randomised control trials or high-quality studies in this territory. However, 35 years, 29 studies, and you can see the results set out there. Not taking people through the court system on the whole is something you should try not to do if you can avoid it. And then just think about the gateway itself. It is over 50 years since the last randomised control trial in this field. And please, before you take away from this the idea that I am obsessed with RCTs, I am not. But if you want to know what works, as in effectiveness, this is the design that you should be pursuing, alongside, as you will see, other things as well. Cautioning has been with us ever since Robert Peel, and probably a good deal before that. But certainly as far as police cautioning, most definitely since Peel. And there was a hiccupy moment in the 1970s where, in fact, Rodzinovitz, who was the founding director of the Institute of Criminology at Cambridge, did a very careful study to look at whether cautioning was something that should be continued in the system, and concluded that it should. And the Steers study from the Oxford Centre said something very similar. It was a necessary part of the system. Indeed, a necessary and large part of the system, if you'll see the data there, 38% of disposals. That is a figure that's rapidly changing and depends on what you count in and what you count out. But whichever way you count it, it's still a large part of the system, even with Mr. Grayling's ambitions to change it. Ambitions which I would say categorically had no basis in evidence. You'll find through this, incidentally, just in case you're in any doubt, I am not a romping fan of the current approach, just in case you're in any doubt. It might just seep through on occasions. But what we've actually seen, which is the sort of slightly chaotic moment, is at the same time as we've got ambitions to change and consult about reductions in cautioning, we've also got an incredible increase in cautioning or in diversion. Firstly, we've got the change to the conditional cautioning gateway, which means that the police now own the decision, not the CPS. And as the founding father of conditional cautioning, that was one of the interesting things about whether the police could get that one right. Informal warnings have expanded and continue to expand, and the government is in the process of legislating to expand it still further with the community remedy. So whatever happens with the current consultation about cautions, the likelihood is that their use is not going to diminish. It may indeed yet grow. And that may well be a good thing. But it would be nice to know on the basis of decent research. Mm-hmm. And the proposing new guidelines, I was responsible for 6 previous sets in one form or another. This will be at least the 7th set. And I would just give you a caution about cautioning, and that is the chances of the latest set actually being used as the set that's actually put into action, I think, are quite small. I did a study on cautioning in Hampshire, which Jennifer will remember, where we discovered there were 3 different sets of guidelines in use concurrently within the force, all being misused and none of them used properly, because actually they weren't terribly helpful to make the decision. And if you look at conditional cautioning, which came in 2003. It's an unevaluated experiment. There was a brief implementation study, but the aim of the exercise, which was to have an approach which incorporated conditions like restorative justice and was applied across a whole range of offences, has most definitely not happened. If you look at that diagram, the light blue section is basically criminal damage, and the dark blue section on the what has happened to the offenders is basically a letter of apology or a bit of compensation. So what has actually happened with conditional cautioning is for a relatively small number, and they are tiny numbers, a relatively small number of offences of criminal damage, basically you are asking an offender for a bit of money or a letter of apology. And in most cases, there's very, very little real restorative justice going on in that process as well. And yet it is 1963 since we actually had a randomised control trial. It was the first one actually in policing by Rose and Hamilton. It was done in the Northwest. It tested simple cautioning versus cautioning plus. It was published in the British Journal of Criminology, and almost without exception, when I talk about this one, faces go blank. With a very few honourable exceptions, folk have not read it. I think that might be because it's not actually online. You have to go and find the older versions of the British Journal of Criminology. They concluded that it was rather unhelpful that in the middle of it, someone had actually moved people out of the slums and made it quite difficult to work out what had actually happened with offenders. And probably the movement of the slums, as we know, some later studies, was probably more impactive than the cautioning plus. But they did find that supervision had a marginally better impact than simple cautioning. They just didn't think that it was a cost-benefit result. Since then, you see this list of studies, and that one of the later speakers was part of one of those. Essentially, we worked out that doing cautions quickly worked better than deferring them. That cautions could net widen, and I think there's quite a lot of evidence of that more recently. That cautions can be discriminatory, and I think particularly because one of the issues with cautioning is you have to admit guilt in order to get it, and therefore you have to have a degree of confidence in the cops, and therefore it is quite likely that if you come from some minority communities, you're less likely to want to make the admission and less likely to get an early caution. And Landau and Nathan certainly found that in 83, and I don't think cautioning data since from the work that I've been doing has shifted that much in that sense. They weren't applied consistently. Gloria, that was your study, and I think there were a series of studies at that time, and that led to the second of those cautioning guidelines that I was, the 1985 ones. There was work on restorative justice involved in cautioning, which looked promising, but no RCTs. Yet, we do know from a whole variety of studies of offenders going into court that first-time offenders, there's a pretty reasonable chance if you convict them the first time, you're actually going to get an increase in offending, not a reduction. You're certainly most likely to get a court sentence of a fine, and having done some recent work on court fines, about 40% of those aren't paid. So compared to the conditional cautioning, some of those aren't paid either, but you've got a comparison between a fine in court, some sort of rehabilitative technique outside it, but no real knowledge of which one of those works best. And the quote on the right, incidentally, is from one of the offenders in the trial. When I'm older, if I go to court, I won't be as scared because I've already done it. And that comes across fairly consistently from the offenders in the trial. And yet we do know from trials in other parts of the criminal justice system that working swiftly and quickly, which on the whole, with a few honourable exceptions, on the whole the court system doesn't do, and I haven't got the data on here tonight, but I could have shown you the data on how long it takes comparatively to deal with cases in court for dealing with cases in the trial that we're doing. And it's not a comparison in favour of court. But swiftness matters, in particular the link between the offending behaviour and the reaction and the response matters. And that certainty, the sense that something will definitely happen if I do something, given that a great deal of what you're expecting to happen is a deterrent impact on the offender, the tighter the link between the behaviour and the risk apprehension, it would appear the more likely you are to get some form of impact. So what do we do in the gateway? When we're making decisions in the gateway, do we actually use evidence at all? Well, we do. A different sort of evidence. We say, is there sufficient evidence to prosecute you? And is it in the public interest to prosecute? On the whole, that public interest test does not include will what I'm about to do actually work? That's not one of the considerations. And I've been through just about every aspect of the public interest test. I can't find any obvious evidence involved in interpreting the public interest test. If you were, however, going to try and compile a set of principles to make that gateway work better, I think you'd come out with this set. First of all, that it would be effective. Whatever you were doing in the gateway, whether you were taking people into the system or out of it, out of the formal system, you would want to make sure that what you did was effective, in that it reduced harm and reduced reoffending rather than increased it. You'd want it to be efficient, because let's be quite clear, it doesn't matter which party's in power, there isn't going to be more money for the criminal justice system, so it's going to have to operate with fairly lean resources, and therefore it should be careful about putting resources into low-harm offenders in a way that takes increased cost. And finally, legitimacy, that it, whatever it does in effectiveness and efficiency needs to be legitimate to victims, to the public, and to offenders. So the trial that I'm running is trying to test all of those aspects. It starts from the presumption you're dealing with a low-harm offender. So if we were going to use evidence to redesign this gateway, we'd probably start with harm. We'd start with trying to triage offenders. After all, just about every other public service triages people at the point where you're making a decision about service. If you go into a hospital, you are triaged. Needs treatment now, doesn't need treatment, go and find treatment in general practice. So we don't practice triaging in the system on the whole, not in a formal sense. Combining deterrence and assistance, on the whole, the focus is far too heavily on, certainly in the gateway, far too heavily on deterrence, as in these people deserve to go to court, and rather less on assistance. Because bear in mind, when you put them into court, 60 to 70% of them are going to get a fine, which is not about assistance, it's about deterrence. Improving the consistency of treatment pre-court, because whatever you do pre-court, and pre-court is not going to disappear as a result of any of the changes taking place. If anything, it's going to increase, as I've suggested. But whatever we should do, we should try and improve the consistency of treatment pre-court. Provide a better match of needs and risk of treatment for offenders in that pre-court process, and give victims a better service. And I'll come on to the victim piece, because we're doing another unique randomised control trial as part of that. So the first piece that we've got in train is we've taken the Police National Computer and used it for big data for the first time. We've taken 100,000 records, we've boiled that down as 100,000 offenders, we've replicated a model from Philadelphia using a technique called random forests, and we've produced a statistical model to predict the harm. And it's a simple triaging model. It's not a sophisticated risk analysis tool, but it's giving you a prediction of the likelihood of a high harm event in the next 2 years, and then whether you have a low or a high risk of it. And it produces a risk pattern for those that are involved in risk assessment would be fairly familiar. So the first bit of the what if would be to take the model that we've developed statistically and apply it as a triage tool. If 62% of your offenders who are coming into the police station are low risk, have a low risk of a high harm event, then surely you could afford to think about not putting them into court and trying to find a solution pre-court with those offenders. If that was the case, then what would you do with them? So the next piece is to test, if you are going to take people into a pre-court treatment, what sort of pre-court treatment would you use? If these are offenders that you would otherwise have prosecuted, what would you do with them? Well, in the case of the Turning Point project, we're holding a deferred prosecution over the offender, a deterrence approach, whilst at the same time agreeing a contract with them to support them to stop offending, a desistant approach, but insisting on compliance for non-prosecution, again, deterrence, and making that a very clear drop-dead moment if you fail to comply. The treatment is of deferred prosecution and, say, targeted at that 60-plus percent of offenders who are low risk, and the method is an RCT, a randomised control trial. The sample, well, they're offenders whom the police have decided to prosecute. So what happens is that they come to the custody officer. Once their custody officer is satisfied, there's sufficient evidence to prosecute and it's in the public interest, they go into the randomizer, which I'll show you in a sec. And once they've gone through the triage tests in the randomizer, they either get assigned a prosecution or to treatment. And you can see one of the, we've triaged them out as low risk at the moment because we haven't got the triage tool, on the basis of prior convictions and a series of offences being ruled out. So the classic randomised control design. As far as I'm aware, this is the first and only time the actual prosecution decision has ever been randomised. There have been lots of studies that have done other things with randomisation, but not this one. We are going to compare, in the course of the next, and I'll show you the timescales in a minute, we are going to compare reoffending cost, and therefore cost-benefit, as well as victim satisfaction. I'm going to skip through this piece because that's just the detail of the randomiser. The randomiser, or the Cambridge Gateway, is an internet-based tool that sits in the custody suite. It does mean we've now got 13,000 randomiser records from which, and I'll touch on this later, from which we can actually now show the level of consistency of custody officers' decision-making, and also the types of reasons why custody officers will not put people into this type of event. And mostly, they're good reasons. There are one or two on the slides which are perhaps not quite so good, but mostly they're thoughtful about why they wouldn't put people into this system. The Turning Point Project, if they're randomised into it, is a voluntary participation. They agree a turning point plan. Compliance means no prosecution. Non-compliance, either by reoffending or a breach, means prosecution. And this is where we've got to thus far. So we've tested it and built it gradually in phases, given this is a completely different and new treatment for the system. 10 cases where we simply sent them all to court, and we've tested the randomiser. 55 where we tested turning point only to make sure that the police offender managers who are doing the turning point process could actually administer it. 204 where we expanded it to the whole of Birmingham, and in that process we made a much more sophisticated approach to the turning point plan. And when we were happy with that, we went to full treatment, and we have a high level of treatment as assigned, and aiming for 400 cases early in the new year. And 400 cases, incidentally, for those that can do things like the power calculation, it's simply because these are low harm offenders. Their level of reoffending is not that high, although it is actually quite considerable, but it's not that high, and therefore we need a reasonably large sample to get a high significance in the subsequent data. What we've got, and if you remember the dial with conditional cautioning, what we've got is a high level of restorative conditions, considerable amount of RJ going on as well, much more than simply compensation, a very high level of rehabilitative conditions, and movement constraint. The one that's actually is now happening, that's increasing, is actually the use in partnership probation of individualised, tailored community payback. Which is also turning out to be quite an interesting condition for this group of offenders, not the least of which, because they have so much to gain from not getting a conviction, their level of turnout to things like community payback is almost 100%. And if you talk to folk who do community payback, that is not the usual experience. They have a very, very, very high level of compliance. These are the sorts of crimes, now that we're running across the whole of Birmingham. There are a mixture of crimes with personal victims and crimes without, but a much richer mix than that diagram you saw with conditional cautioning. Criminal damage, which is by far the largest piece of conditional cautioning, is only 12% here. Most of them are property and violent offences. Incidentally, included in those violent offences are quite a number of assaults police, including assaults police where the officers have gone for restorative justice with their own colleagues, which indicates that there's actually been quite a high level of commitment inside the force to try and test this properly. As a profile of the offenders, you will note we've got a 25%, 75% male-female split. We've also incidentally got the data on. We've also got data on ethnicity. You will notice on the right-hand side of this one, we're pretty close to parity on ethnicity, much closer than the equivalent cautioning data, which I could have put up at the same time, but much closer than the equivalent data. And given that we're in right in the centre of Birmingham, that actually is quite creditable that we're so reasonably balanced out on that. I think I'd still want to monitor it very carefully, but it looks as if it does result in an improvement in terms of parity. The challenge, of course, is if you are going to make this work, and you're going to make this work in a consistent and transparent way, which has been one of the objections advanced for pre-court conditions, it needs to be done in a very professional way. There is tremendous potential to to try and reduce offending to satisfy victims and cut criminal justice costs, but substantial risks of putting in backfiring conditions. Certainly saw one or two of the early conditions. We thought when we started out that we could effectively trust cops to come up with sensible conditions, and the force was trying to give officers a lot of discretion. Some of the first sets of conditions did include some ones which we know well from the literature are backfire. So we've, as you'll see in a minute, we've stepped in and actually gone for a much tighter evidence-based and controlled approach to conditions. There was also a potential for upsetting victims. And again, in the early stages, we had a number of cops who we couldn't train everybody in the whole of Birmingham, so we trained about 400, but we didn't train everyone. We still had some police officers telling their victims that this was a cost-cutting measure, and they were very sorry, but they should have been prosecuted. That didn't really help, as you can imagine, victim satisfaction. And, of course, potentially, you could get a loss of public trust and confidence. And getting the balance right between giving officers discretion on the one hand and ending up with the sort of prescribed decision-making which has been so rightly criticised over recent years, getting that balance to what we've called supported decision-making has been the reason why it's taken us three stages to get to the point where we're satisfied that we're doing something consistently different. And to do that, firstly, we've had to make sure that we monitor very carefully. We put this box in on the randomizer called box 17, or question was originally 14, but question 17. And we monitor what the reasons that they specify in box 17 very carefully. We want to monitor patterns for it because the randomizer is set up so we can look at patterns of decision making by individual custody officers. We can look at patterns of reasons why people are being knocked out of the system. And there have been a couple that have emerged where, you know, on the whole, turning point is not suitable for someone when there is a gross breach of trust involved in the offence. The level of acceptance by victims of turning point for that type of offence is very low, and we think the custody officers on the whole are right to take those out. But some of the other reasons not quite so good. So, for example, the prisoner in custody is a severe alcoholic and I fear turning point may be too late for him is not probably a good reason not to try it. Offender showed intent. Well, on the whole, if you're going to prosecute him, he bloody well should do. No remorse, i.e. he failed the attitude test, has been given the opportunity to complete restorative justice and refused to cooperate. Actually, they have to cooperate with restorative justice. It's not, they have to consent to it. It's not a no if they don't want to do it. And a long-standing, ongoing neighbour dispute. Well, of course, a lot of the offences in this category will be of that nature, and using this type of problem-solving approach is probably quite effective. So, a little bit of data. We started with discretion only, and you can see we had some problems. These bar charts just trying to show us the level of consistency with the type of action, the type of means being used in the conditions and the quantity, the specification of what they actually had to do. Gradually, by more training, we made some improvement. By putting in some recommended conditions on paper, we had some impact, but it wasn't, frankly, until we got to a highly set basic decision support IT, which actually we didn't devise as researchers. It was devised by the offender managers themselves. We gave them a very substantial write-up on the evidence. They designed a decision support package for themselves, and they have, with the forces support and the IT support, have implemented it. And as a result, not only does that help us enormously with the data gathering, but we have got incredibly consistent, not just the type of plan, but the dosage and the length of time the dosage has got to be delivered. So in terms of the type of techniques that you use in a pharmacy, we're trying to apply those type of techniques of getting the right dosage for the right offender. And making sure the conditions are smart, giving them some flexibility still to vary it if they want to vary it, and to be able to adapt it or increase it as possible, and choosing the pathways. And also, of course, the pathways in this case being only as good as the partners and their ability to support us. The other part of the trial that emerged as we've been going through has been the force themselves raised the issue, well, what's the victim experience? And we had originally planned to do some victim work towards the back end of it, but the forces was quite rightly insistent we looked at it. So we then adapted in stage four, we adapted the design to block randomised cases, personal victim or no, and we're doing a very specific piece of work surveying the victims, comparing the experience of going through Turning Point with the experience of going through court. and looking at the differences in that experience. As far as I know, that's the first time. I'm looking at one or two of our victims' experts. I don't think anyone else has done it that way. They have a partial veto in the sense that they don't have a complete veto in the actual decision to take somebody into Turning Point, but they do have a very considerable amount of involvement in the type of decision, conditions embedded in it. The aim of the exercise is as much as possible to take the victim's views into account, particularly when it's an assault case, prior to making the decision about the public interest. And some custody officers have used that as a question 17 dropout. So we're looking. We did some interviews in stages 1 and 2, and that produced us some concerns for us about the way in which the message about Turning Point was being conveyed and the structure about the way that it was being done. I hasten to add, it also conveyed in us very substantial alarm about the way in which the message about just about any pre-court or court disposal was being given by the force to victims, which I don't think will be news to anyone who's researched victim support. Hence the need to then, we redesigned the victim approach around the best practice around restorative justice, and we're now testing to see whether that's actually produced, and so far the early data is very positive, but we've got quite a few more interviews to do before I'd give you results on that one. We start with restorative questions. We discuss the police motives, the idea that what we're trying to do is to reduce reoffending. We focus on why, so what the desired outcomes are for the victim and what the desired outcomes for the offender from the victim might be. Interestingly, the texts kind of emphasise that this should be a personal meeting, and we try very hard to do that, but the reality is that first conversation on the phone with the offender manager and who's dealing with the victim turns out to be a much more powerful way of doing it. And the experience of offender managers is you just follow straight through with the script on the phone, and that appears to work. And I put some on the slides, I put some of the feedback from the victims that have been coming through in the survey work, which they do look promising. As I say, I can't give you results. I can, at the moment, can only give you qualitative data. I'm not going to read every single one of those out, but on the whole, these are fairly consistent in terms of impact. The one thing that most definitely comes across is the victim's earnest desire to see something positive done about the offender and the offender's behaviour. There are some offenders who clearly want that to be in a form of very firm punishment, but most not. And finally, which is the last piece of the work that we're testing, is of course the other part of the criticism of consistency. Okay, we can be consistent about getting conditions right, but can we be consistent about matching those effectively to the offender? And so the offender managers, having got themselves extremely, this is a group of about 30 officers who mostly deal with very serious offenders, but having got themselves very interested in doing this in a different way, asked the question, well, is there anything better than our judgment? Is there a tool that we could use that would match the needs and risks more accurately? And so we, having looked across the literature, identified the learning skills case management inventory as the one which has got the best evidence to support it, and are now testing LSCMI as the front end of that portal. So it's effective. What LSCMI does is it gives you a scripted approach based on Bonta's and Andrews and Bonta's very careful evidence on the match between the offender's pathway and their risk, and then the potential routes to trying to reduce that risk. And we've trained the offender managers in that process, and that we've now matched that LSCMI assessment into the portal. Again, there is nothing like this out there in the police service whatsoever. Most of this work has been done on I know very well because I was responsible for doing the matrix on cautioning. We've never got anywhere near a process in the police station or with offender managers that's tried to do this type of work. Some of you might argue it's the sort of work you would expect a probation officer to do. I know, but this is pre-court. This is pre-court, and it's not in the purview of probation officers. If you wait till it gets to probation officer, they've got to go to court and get a conviction to get it. And, of course, most of the research has looked at trying to do this post-court. So this is trying to bring back the lessons and the language. And of course, there are some opportunities, depending on what happens with the rehabilitative. I gather it's now an evolution, not a revolution. But the rehabilitative revolution, there are some possibilities of some interesting partnerships in future, if whatever happens. So what if? What if low-harm offenders were triaged to treatments supported by a deferred prosecution and high harm into offender management? So the gateway operated as a triage between high harm offenders who are getting the type of intensive treatment that we built between police offender managers and probation officers, and low harm offenders were triaged to the police working in conjunction mostly with third sector organisations actually. Integrated approach by the police and partners to combine deterrence and assistance, and in the case of the Turning Point process, increasing partnership with not just the probation service but other partners to deliver some of those treatments. Improved professional decision making and practice. Actually, I would say, just take the improved out, professional decision making and practice in this territory. Actually using standards of practice that are based on evidence, not standard of practice which just happened to be the way we've always done things around here. Certainly, overall then, a much better service. After all, if you're doing all of those things, it's much easier to explain to a victim why you're doing it, and much more easier to explain what you're trying to do, and you have a language to explain that, which is based on evidence and the probability of some positive outcome. And it may well be cost-effective. I can't tell you the answer to that. The results will tell that. And I'm a disciplined enough researcher now to not tell you what the answers are until I actually know them. And I suspect the answers will probably be they'll certainly be the end of 2014, it might be early 2015, but it will be a little while before we know exactly how that's gone. What we do know is that it has certainly produced a better, more consistent practice in custody suites and in amongst offender managers. What we don't know is the outcome yet that's produced. That's my what if. Thank you.
That's absolutely fantastic. No, stay here. Well, there's another chair here. Come up, you two. Over there. We'll go straight into the discussion bit. Who's going to go first? You can see we've organised this in advance, can't we?
Okay, I'll go.
Okay.
My voice is a bit funny because I've got a cold, so excuse me, and I might need a drink at some point. Right, I'm going to make my comments in two parts. One big part, which is at a fairly high level on the principles of Peter's talk, and the second is a couple of points of detail. But first, let me just say that I totally agree with Peter about the need for evaluation, the need for evidence, the need for experimentation and the need for reform. But for the sake of discussion, I'm going to be Professor Picky and just make the point to start with that my comments are made against a backdrop of financial restraint. I might think, yeah, let's just do everything, but at what cost? And I've taken 3 points. These three discussion points are from Peter's abstract, rather than his main talk. These are the points he chose to sort of highlight in the abstract that I saw. I'm going to focus on these three, and I'm going to start with the first one, which was to say reforms have largely focused on the post-charge or post-conviction challenge of setting sentences and then achieving deterrence, rehabilitation and assistance. I'm not sure that's right. I think there's been a significant shift toward crime reduction since the 1998 Crime and Disorder Act, and that reform was pre-charge, arrest and so on, and it wasn't about deterrence or rehabilitation or desistance, it was about prevention, and it was absolutely massive. It resulted in crime and disorder partnerships all over the country, and it resulted in problem solving and the sort of thing that I personally am very keen on. I also have a sense that it's disappearing down a plug hole as the Met make redundant vast numbers of analysts, and it's not just the Metropolitan Police, it's police forces all over the place. So that really useful basis is in danger of being seriously knocked. The second point Peter made was this leaves huge numbers of low-harm offenders entering a court system and over 60% emerging with a fine and little real attempt to tackle the causes of their offending. I think that's probably right, but it does rather beg the question of what are the causes of crime? And we know about the risk factors, poor education, bad parenting, poverty and so on, but is structured diversion or deferred prosecution really dealing with the causes? If I can be provocative, I think opportunities cause crime. For example, well, let me just make two statements that are particularly provocative and gross generalisations. But there are opportunistic offenders who are easily deterred, but there's lots of them. And they're the low-risk casual offenders. And if I asked you all to put your hand up if you'd ever committed an offence, about 90% of you should put your hands up, if not more. Proper, professional offenders, they're not easily deterred. There are far fewer of them, and they're the ones we need to catch and deal with far more seriously. But those opportunistic offenders are the ones that drove that, the crime rate per 1,000 population in England and Wales from the end of the First World War till 1994. The number of things to steal, the number of young people, the time on their hands, all those things grew over that period. Since then, it's dropped, and that hiccup there's, I think, probably to do with changes in recording and reporting. That drop that we've all been wondering about over the last, 10 years or so, I would argue has been driven down by taking a much more problem-oriented approach to policing, or to crime control, if I can put it that way. I'll give you an example, and this works in my opinion. This is data on theft of and from vehicles. You can see that theft of vehicles and theft from vehicles dropped massively from about 1992. Why? Because at that time the manufacturers put deadlocks and immobilisers on all cars at the point of manufacture, so they're much less easy to steal. And there's a lot of evidence that that drop is caused primarily by a drop in opportunistic offenders joyriding. When I was younger, around the 70s or what have you, around the 80s actually, early 80s, late 80s, you'll remember, Peter, there was a spate of joyriding in Thames Valley. And the minister at the time was from that area, beside himself, because these awful kids were driving like lunatics in stolen vehicles, and all the community out there cheering and enjoying themselves, having a night out watching these kids. That doesn't happen now. And one of the reasons it doesn't happen is because it's something more difficult to steal a car. According to the government, and we can argue with these figures till the cows come home, but most of them are supported by the British Crime Survey, there's been a 65% reduction in vehicle crime, a 53% reduction in credit card fraud, 29% reduction in personal robbery, 60% reduction in house burglary. And I think a lot of that's been driven by taking problem-solving approach and by trying to redesign the situation rather than redesign the people. It's almost impossible to redesign people. But situations are much easier to change. So, what do we do who want to reduce crime? And I say reduce crime because then we've got fewer victims, but we've also got fewer of the opportunistic, low-rate offenders. I think we need to behave in a more objective and scientific manner, and on this I absolutely agree with Peter that that's what we've definitely got to do. I'd start with preventing as many offences as possible in the first place, and for me that means asking the police to spend their time solving crime problems rather than reacting to them. For sure, we need to catch offenders more effectively. In other words, it's the certitude of being caught rather than the severity or the consequential punishment that matters. And we need to deal with them efficiently. And we need to avoid overestimating the importance of individual character traits and not underestimate the importance of situation and context. And this is an extremely important point. It's what psychologists call the fundamental attribution error. And I think it's an error that's being made on the notion that what we need to do is take these offenders and do something to them. The fundamental attribution error is what happens when I say, I commit an offence. It wasn't my fault. I had a good reason. Something awful had happened, and that's why I did it. It just wasn't me. It was the situation. If you commit an offence, it's because you're a bad person, you're not nice, we need to catch you, we need to punish you, we need to do something ghastly to you. That's the fundamental attribution error, and that's what drives criminal justice systems globally. Peter's third point, triaging offenders with a low harm profile to structure diversion or deferred prosecution, might encourage more offenders away from offending at an early stage before offending becomes embedded. Well, it might, we'll see. But by the time even low-harm offenders are first arrested, their offending patterns are probably well on the way to being embedded. And I say this because of this. Many of you will know this very well. It's for every 100 offences committed, the public report 50 to the police, of which they record 30 and so on. That's usually seen by the Home Office who produce the chart as a measure of the ineffectiveness or inefficiency of the criminal justice system. They'd like the figures to be better, obviously, that too. They'd like to be closer to the 100 or something. But what it also says is we can't control crime using the CJS. It tells us that most offenders don't get caught, and it tells us if you want crime to go down, you've got to do something else. Most offenders don't get caught. I wonder how many of you were caught when you broke whatever law you'd confessed to breaking. I won't ask. But most offenders don't get caught, so they're used to the idea that they're going to get away with crime before they ever get arrested the first time. So those are my general points. On the detail, just two other questions I wanted to raise. The first, I'm curious about how it really differs from a police caution or court-based conditional discharge with beefed-up conditions. I mean, are we just saying, let's just beef up the conditions a bit more and hope we can engage with the probation service and everybody else to help us beef those things up? And also, particularly, how does it differ from David Kennedy's work on deterrence as crime, as crime prevention? And if I just explain briefly what Kennedy's work is. He wrote a book called Deterrence as Crime Prevention, which I'm an enormous fan of. This quote here is from an Amazon reviewer, but I think he was a really good reviewer because he's very concise. He moves the discussion of deterrence far beyond the normal focus on certainty versus severity of punishment. For example, most potential criminals don't know what their punishment might be, and Kennedy says maybe we should tell them. What actually motivates them is often not what we might think. For example, it's not fear of going to prison. It might be that they're not going to see their girlfriend for a while. And enforcement is often better directed at groups like gangs rather than at individuals, like gang members. They make that point because a lot of Kennedy's work is about gangs. So Kennedy's work is about using levers to try changing offending behaviour. It is extremely resource intensive. And as Kennedy envisages it, it can only be done properly on a small sample of, in his case, extremely serious offenders. It requires an intimate knowledge of the vulnerabilities, and I put that in quotes, of the offender. It's, if you're pulling levers, you have to kind of threaten the offender with something they care about. You know, telling me I won't see my grandchildren, I care. You know, telling me something else, and I might not care. I mean, I'd care anyway, to be honest. I'd be horribly embarrassed if I were arrested. I was once cautioned of having a lump on my tire and I nearly died of fright. But Brendan Behan wrote a book called Borster Boy, for example, when he was seriously upset because he only went to an open borstal and his father had been to a closed borstal. And how embarrassing was that? So, you know, it's horses for courses. So what would I do? I'd try to tackle low harm but high rates of minor crime using problem solving and reduce the opportunities that cause crime. I'm sorry, I'm going the wrong way. Oh, dear. I'll go away. And I'd use Peter's triage approach for serious offenders because there are fewer of them and they cause more harm. And I draw on Kennedy's work in doing so. Gordon Bennett. That said, I'm a big fan of experiments and evidence-based policy. So basically, Peter, let's see what happens.
Myself on. Right.
Now, I've never used PowerPoint. I've just never used it. I don't understand it. I'm impressed. I can tweet. I like my phone.
Those of you who know me will be relieved to know that it's just the one slide. I've knocked this together in great haste, so it won't be with my usual semi-spontaneous delivery, I'm afraid. Also because I'm somewhat out of my comfort zone moving into the judicial side of things. So, but bear with me. I think that there are respectable precedents in the justice field for something sort of quite like triage, but maybe not with the tree. Small claims processes versus full-blown civil lawsuits, summary trial versus jury trial, that sort of thing. They all trade off things like harm of the offence, harm from maladroit interventions, the cost, the effort, and the limited channel capacity for processing cases intensively. So no reason at all not to explore it in this context. So in that respect, I think the what-if question already has a partial answer in policy and practice terms, though not necessarily in terms of adequate research and theory. So I think we're left to examine the immediate what-if question on triage of pre-charge offenders in diabolical detail rather than in principle. But we're also faced with this wider issue, the question in the title, what if evidence was used rather than tradition? I can still hear Peter Cook's Amnesty International Jeremy Thorpe trial thing. And we had to listen to the evidence. Any of you remember that? What if design was used, which could include design of research and evaluation, but also design of systems, service design, procedural design? I have some experience of that sort of thing, having worked among, I call myself a criminologist fallen among designers, having worked at Central St Martins for some years. So to what if we might add the corollary questions? Why have evidence and design not been sufficiently used up to now? What's been stopping us and how can we get round these obstacles? And I still remember Charles Clarke saying when he was Home Secretary, no, when he was a junior minister before that even less happy session, saying, "I don't like pilots." And he wasn't talking about aviators, but methodology.
How can anybody?
Never mind. I feel a rant coming on even now. Overall, I found the analysis, the content, the development and the design process of what Peter's been doing very impressive. And on the design in particular, we had classic designy things like detailed stakeholder analysis, reflecting what the different parties wanted out of the system. We had sensitivity to multiple drivers, conflicting requirements such as security, justice and economy. And we had a deliberate process of iterative trial and improvement. And we had a user-centred approach to designing a working system, including all this decision support software and guidance materials. So, a few words now on content and concepts. It's always welcome to see harm reduction alongside justice, and whether that harm comes from what the offender's doing or sort of iatrogenic harm from society's clumsy attempts to deal with the offender and the offence. On the conceptual front, I still have some issues with what is desistance. appears to me that desistance is an outcome, whereas deterrence is one mechanism to achieve it. I mean, the mechanism underlying deterrence is fairly clear-cut, at least you get to the sort of neuropsychology level, which I'm not going to. The offender perceives a significant risk of aversive consequences of some action and decides to avoid doing it. Desistance isn't explicitly defined in Peter's slides, at least, though he may have more to say about it. It kind of illustrates it by things like agreeing a contract to support the offender to stop offending. So I think we need to home in a bit more on what exactly the underlying mechanisms of desistance are. I mean, is it kind of similar process of decision and adherence to some decision? Is it involve some sort of commitment process to other people or to oneself, development of social bonds and so on? I mean, some researchers have moved away from thinking about it as a kind of individualistic concept to something which is much more related to social processes, social capital and cohesion in the community. So there's a bit more consideration on that. So let's move on to process and implementation. Now, Peter's already been probed on the fact that police officers here are doing something similar to what probation officers do post conviction. And, you know, the question remains, are police capable of doing this to an adequate level of quality? At what point do they... somebody says no. You know, is there a kind of triage there between police doing quick and simple ones following some of the guidance? Do they know when to refer it on if they find something's getting really complicated? And are there supervisors up to quality assurance of the operational officers? We have the sort of this risk need responsivity issue, and I mean this must be a pretty demanding process to achieve in practice. How do you balance discretion and adjustment to context against some sort of discipline and rigour without getting strangled by what somebody once called programme fetishism, where you follow everything in every last detail? And in this respect, I really like the practical address in this project to supported decision making as the sort of third way, dare I say, equivalent to, on the one hand, completely prescribed responses, and on the other hand, totally free discretion. So let's move on briefly to evaluation methodology. And I was just wondering how voluntary participation relates to random assignment and whether there are any particularly tricky issues here. And I think we've got two levels of voluntary. We've got voluntary from the point of view of the offender and also voluntary from the point of view of the victim. I mean, it'd be interesting to see how far the voluntariness requirement actually causes attrition of all the people that might have gone into this funnel. The conditions that are available to impose on offenders within turning point seem to be extremely varied, and I wonder how this affects how one conducts evaluation. I mean, in a sense, it's a bit analogous to evaluation of problem-oriented policing or communities that care, where you're evaluating a process which doesn't have a uniform output, but all the menu of outputs which can be applied hopefully end up to a common desired outcome. One particular thing I thought of, the gateway process seems to involve a combination of desistance and specific deterrence. I'm just wondering what the impact was on general deterrence. The people out there, potential offenders, what do they think of this when it gets publicised in the papers and so on? Do they see it as a soft touch or what? So one aspect of the evaluation at the Campbell systematic review approach is don't report on very well at the moment, which is what I call deliverability. How robust is the programme in its potential to sort of roll out and replicate across the country? What might be differing local contexts without mishap or implementation failure? I mean, is it, on the one hand, is it like a sort of wild rocket plant that will spring up and flourish in most soils, whatever you do to it, and it's still edible? Or is it a Webb's wonder that needs careful sort of greenhouse cover and lots of slug pellets? Moving on to the operating context of the Turning Point system. One, how much the sort of gateway process in general, which balances prescription and discretion, actually sort of fits in with the localism movement. I mean, as an aside here, it was all supposed to be localist, wasn't it? But certainly in the crime prevention, town planning, crime prevention through environmental design world, any pretense at localism seems to have been thrown right out of the window with the simplification of the planning laws. The issue of climate of acceptance is another thing which concerns me a bit. It is well taken, Peter's claim, that the Turning Point system's got tremendous potential, but it's also got substantial risks. So that means the stakes are pretty high. I mean, we've all seen how the Daily Mail in particular has got this long history of sort of serial killer of rational justice initiatives. And I wondered whether the programme has got any kind of strategy ready thought through to set expectations and establish legitimacy, to anticipate, sort of prepare for and refute unfortunate events where, you know, the offender might be seen to be getting away with something at the time or go on to commit worse crimes and so on, or where victims feel badly done by. Can we actually design a system following sort of Haddon matrix? Makes bad outcomes less likely, can intervene to limit the damage if a case is starting to go wrong, and can recover and rehabilitate the system if something does go completely wrong. Finally, on learning and feedback, I'm really pleased to see the programme involved some iterations before procedures were finalised. But there's another issue here, which is once it's running, I mean, there's a bit of a tendency to fire and forget. I wonder whether there's any sort of vision for keeping updating, modifying the triage principles and practice in the light of accumulating experience and evidence. So that's really another what if to end on. What if our justice and crime prevention approaches were subject to the sort of iterative shakedown, improvement, updating and adaptation to wider changes in society on a sort of more routine and embedded basis rather than just occasional punctuated evolution events only when some kind of judicial disaster occurs? There's some way that we can make the statutory system and how it improves and adapts to change more smoothly responsive than kind of San Andreas fault, where you kind of get years of building up tension and then a massive earthquake. Thank you.
Yeah, do a quick piece. Most of it will be agreement. Taking Gloria's points, completely agree that the primary preventive approach most definitely is about place and opportunity and problem solving. But you are going to be arresting people, and people become part of the system at that point, and they are a significant part of the system at that point. And yes, of course, the causes, the long-term causes of crime go deep, but if you look at the offenders involved in the trial, the short-term causes, which you can fix in most cases, are actually not that deep. They're immediate. I've lost employment. I don't know what to do. I have an immediate problem with my family. I don't know what to do. They are quite, on the whole, quite short term. Although I do think one of the things that the evaluation will show up is there is a difference between the short term problems you can fix and the more embedded one. And certainly one of the pieces that my daughter, who's doing the data management, has spotted is there are some offenders where we can already identify the probable long-term onset because of well, you know, some of the well-known factors, in particular the being a victim in a significant sense before offending. And in terms of does it really differ from caution and caution conditions, oh yes, it most definitely does differ from all the other pieces. And I think, you know, even if we weren't doing it for other reasons, it is absolutely imperative before we go launching into community remedy, which, God help us, policing and crime commissioners are supposed to be agreeing. If there ever was a recipe for disaster, that is it. That before we go down that track, it would be awfully nice if some of the conditions that they were putting on the menu du jour of the community remedy were actually underpinned by some evidence. I think that David Kennedy's work is, I mean, which I know very well, is different because you're dealing with most of his work is focused on gang members in serious crime. Although the pulling levers, the focused deterrence approach has some relevance and certainly can be put back into this piece. But I think what I would say in overall point is that this is not an either or to do problem solving and place based approaches and a people based approach in this way. I think the two are complementary, and indeed should be complementary, because the data coming out of this should be used to inform preventive strategies as well. On Paul's points, I'm grateful you like supported decision making, because it is a fundamental lesson, I think, of this process. In terms of your points about voluntary participation and design, we are clearly, for those that are familiar with it, with randomised control trial designs, we're very, very tight on making sure we measure as intended to treat, and that's an extremely important part of the process. And also that, as far as possible, the spine of conditions is consistent for everyone in one sense, that they all have to agree a contract and they all have to abide by it and not reoffend. So there are always two conditions that are the same for everyone. The others are varied around it and linked to their behaviour. So we will, in the way that we've set the evaluation design up, be able to evaluate in a whole variety of different ways, to be able to look at different approaches and different impacts. No idea what the impact on general deterrence is. I'm not even sure how I would necessarily measure that. But given that it is not widely, we've been very quiet and not widely publicised it. I've made a secret of it because I've, you know, coming to events like this, we've not made a secret of it, but we haven't widely publicised it. I doubt whether there is much of an impact on general deterrence. Not that that's a subject that has either been particularly well studied. In terms of deliverability, this was very, very carefully designed to be deliverable more widely. I won a very significant argument with my mentor and supervisor, Larry Sherman. He wanted a specialist team. I said, if you make it a specialist team, I can't deliver it anywhere else. So it is not a specialist team, as a result of which we've had to train about 400 people. So we've effectively taken, you know, it's the whole of Birmingham, which is a very large city that we're doing it in. So we're not doing this in a small scale, we're doing it on a large scale. If you can deliver it in the whole of Birmingham, I reckon you can deliver it pretty much anywhere else. And in terms of localism prescription, of course you can design the conditions to reflect particular problems in a community. That's not difficult, as long as, of course, you design them around evidence. I'm not sure there's anything that will protect you from the Daily Mail, bless the Daily Mail, and all that's said in there. And having had the treatment when I introduced conditional cautioning, I got the full Little John treatment and a front page in, I think it was The Sun, which said, an apology for a chief constable. I'm well and truly familiar with the Daily Mail treatment on that, and I have no particular feelings one way or the other on that one. If it comes, it comes. But I think we have a good and defendable case, not the least of which, because we've taken so much time to do the work with victims, which I do think is the most significant response of how much care we've taken to make sure that victims are getting a good deal out of this and are being taken into account in the process. Thank you.
That's given you lots to think about. It's been absolutely fascinating. Now, I'm going to give half an hour to questions and discussion from the audience. We have a roving mic over there. So stick your hand up if you want to say something. Identify who you are, please, because it's interesting to know. Just over here. Thank you.
Roger Hovell. I am a date-expired magistrate, but I did sit on the youth court for a number of years. The overall idea, I think, is good, but I'd like to comment from the youth standpoint. In the youth court, we were often left thinking, why was this case ever brought? Now, certainly there were cases which should have been brought. We had the youngest drink driver ever, 12. Yes, they reoffended. A boy who had a meat cleaver in his briefcase to collect mobile phones at school. But on the other hand, there was a case where a young person in a care home was brought to court for assault, throwing a jug of water over somebody in the care home. In mitigation, it turned out that both her parents were serving life sentences for manslaughter of one of the siblings through a drug overdose. And you thought, well, you know, there are real underlying problems there. Then, of course, there's the playground bullying, and then a difficult case where a granny reports a grandchild for stealing money from her and thinks the child should be taught a lesson. So that is all hard. But on the other hand, my definition of crime is it's like weeds in a garden. There will always be weeds in the garden. The best one can do is to control the weeds, try and destroy all the weeds, and you may destroy the garden. And the reason I say that is, go back to St. Augustine and the pears, and he stole them for the buzz. And this is one of the difficulties with young people. They are there and they enjoy excitement. Now, if you stamp out that excitement, where does it go? Where does it lead? I hear car crime is down. Well, is this just the dustbin lid being held on the dustbin? Where will the excitement come from? But in general principle, I think it's an excellent idea.
I think I'll take another couple of, and then I'll give the whole panel a chance to respond. And we've got somebody else who wants to say something? Out there. Thank you.
Hi, Lucy Terry from Revolving Doors Agency. I was just wondering, is it fundamentally different from the conditional cautions because of deferred prosecution or some other reason?
Thank you. Anybody else who wants to make a comment or a question? Lady up here, right in the middle. Oh, okay, sorry, I couldn't see you behind the screen.
It's Noel Staples, I'm a retired social worker. I was intrigued by the reference to the activities of police officers being rather like probation officers in the position of triaging. There are a whole different set of skills which are required for triaging. As far as I know, they don't come into police officers' training, but I think it would be a very good thing if they did. I wonder what your thoughts were on, your further thoughts were on that.
I'll take the lady here. One more, then I'll give you Peter first, and then I'll go to you.
I'm Nasreen Anderson. I'm working currently as a defence solicitor. And my question was really, I appreciate that this is before they all get to court, but specifically with youths, obviously they have a referral order, which does something very similar. It obviously looks in, well, they have a contract, and it deals with reparation and rehabilitation. But I know, because I represent the same people week in, week out, that they often don't work. And this is with youths who are potentially the most mouldable in society. So my question was, what would make this work when referral orders aren't necessarily working as well as they should do?
Okay, deal with the last one. I mean, the big incentive is you don't get a conviction. And if you look at the long list of things that stops you doing, getting a conviction, if you get a referral, you've got a conviction. Well, it won't show up on a...
It shows on a CRB check.
I was going to say, it shows on a CRB check. I mean, I, you know, unless somebody wants to dramatically change the CRB process, which I wouldn't argue against, to be honest, because I think it's a very interesting question there. But a conviction is a conviction, and indeed a caution is a finding of guilt, and is also something you have to. I mean, you know, I do a lot of I get a lot of people asking me for advice about joining the police service, About 60% of the people that speak to me about it, many of whom I've known, who, you know, for example, I've coached them in cricket, etc., really nice kids, would make great police officers, but they, you know, they went to Reading Festival and they got themselves a caution. They can't join the police service because, well, they won't get in. End of. They are straight out. And you start listing the number of jobs where you are not going to get a job because you just won't even get in the paper sift if you've got a conviction. I think it's a massive gain, and the kids know it as well. I mean, and I should clarify, there are both youngsters and adults in this trial as well, and there are two slightly different treatments, one on the other. So not getting a conviction is a massive potential gain. Okay, you are in the system on the basis that it will note the West Midlands Intelligence System will note that you've been through the system, but you're not on the PNC with a conviction, you've got no finding of guilt. And incidentally, the difference between this and conditional cautioning is that right from the start, I argued that they should not have to admit guilt to be going through this process. And this is an interesting one, of course, for a defence solicitor, because I said this has always been the flaw with the cautioning system. You've got people who could perfectly easily process through it, but they don't want to admit it, either because they don't admit it because they're sat beside their mum and dad and they don't want to I'm going to return to police language, I'm going to say cough the job, but they don't want to admit the job alongside mum and dad, or they don't trust the police. And there are, you know, there are plenty of folk in central Birmingham whose trust in police is not great. And therefore, they are immediately disadvantaged in that process. So one of the big things about this is a deferred prosecution. You can go to court if you want to go to court. That's the voluntary piece on it. But you obviously won't get the turning point process. So it is different from conditional cautioning. And therefore, of course, it's including everyone. We've incidentally only had, of the 600 cases that you saw going through, we've only had one person who's actually gone to court and elected to go to court and been found not guilty. So it does seem to be reasonably accurate. There's been a few discontinuances, but on the whole, the accuracy of treatment seems to be quite high. I mean, my point is certainly about on the youth court side of things. I like the St. Augustine quote, but actually, I think it's slightly wrong. In this case, what we're trying to do is to treat the weeds as flowers. And the whole process, and it's one of the really fascinating things about the early qualitative work we did with offenders. They had never been spoken to by cops like this. They had never had a conversation with a police officer saying, now talk to me about your offending and why you're doing it. So back to the social work point, it is a transformative discussion for a police offender manager to have with a young or indeed adult offender of, you know, what can we do to stop you offending? It is a different quality conversation because obviously the police officer is there to have with a slightly different role, but nevertheless it's an interesting conversation and it produces incredibly positive responses from the vast majority of offenders. I mean, and you can divide the offenders into the ones that turn up on day one, who almost all have gone through the whole process, and the ones who don't turn up. And I think that's the same with the court system. If they fail to turn up on a first appearance, you've probably got a bad one. And I think it's the same. It seems to be the same with Turning Point. If they fail to turn up, they fail to comply, you are probably looking at somewhat longer process of treatment. And I think that's probably... I mean, the triaging process for police officers, it is a point that what's happening in police forces, which has not been well documented, the research hasn't caught up with the practice, is the one thing that was being invested in heavily in austerity is the police are switching their strategies to dealing with offending to offender management. Now, again, without, as yet, the type of deep embedded evidence to support it, although there is some beginning to emerge. But in doing so, the training and the development of police officers to deal with offenders, even as police officers seeking to deter, has not caught up with the practice that's been developing. And that's something that needs to happen quite. And this is part of that process. LSCMI is, of course, not just a technique that you can use with the low-harm offenders. It's extremely capable and is being deployed in West Midlands now to deal with the high-harm offenders. And therefore, the join between probation practice and police practice, which, to be frank, the rehabilitative revolution carries a massive, massive risk of breaking something that is looking incredibly promising at reducing. I could weep, as could a number of folk, about something that is so incredibly stupid and ill thought through and carries such high risks of damaging practice just at the point where it is changing in a way that is really quite promising. Here endeth the lesson.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, just
just very quickly on the point that you were making, Roger. I mean, it would be really good to have some sort of feedback mechanism to the police in those circumstances. I'm not quite sure why this person is there. I suppose the way to do that is to give them some sort of a list. The point about the triaging requiring extra skills, I think that's really important. But it also reminds me of the point I was trying to make right at the beginning, that we're talking about all this against a backdrop of cuts and pressure and reduced police numbers. And my problem is they're now saying we haven't got time for this problem-solving stuff, which we do know works. And now you want them to take on the role of social workers or whatever. I mean, I don't say that in any sense disparaging, because some of my best friends are social workers. The police wouldn't admit. I mean, that's just the police culture is terribly given to the notion of social work and probation. Typically don't much respect each other. Maybe things have changed. But, I mean, when I was in the prison officers couldn't stand the social workers. The police weren't worried about them either, because they see them as defending the offenders and helping them, and that's exactly what they're there to do. So there's a kind of schizophrenic expectation of police officers if they've got to do both. That's not an argument for not doing it if we'd all got all the time in the world, but half doing it or doing it badly seems sort of worse than not doing it at all. And there isn't, I don't think there are the resources there at the moment to do it.
Just a couple of things, really. I noticed your comments about excitement and how young men particularly value risk. So how can we provide socially acceptable risk that's also acceptable to young people, being genuine risk within reason, in such a controlled health and safety society? Is sports the only alternative? I mean, one does get all these sort of outward bound type courses and so on and so forth. I don't know whether there's any evidentiary base at that level as well. So I think we need a whole lot of sort of experimental social innovations to see what can be delivered to satisfy this perennial need for many young people as they go through a particular phase of neurological development. Let's try and test it. But the trouble is, once you organise something, it becomes really spontaneous, it loses its spontaneity. I remember I got in a very bad mood when I was a child. I must go outside and break a bottle, and the parents came out and made sure it was all safe and so on. It was bloody useless, So that's the sort of thing you have to balance with some imagination. But you get spontaneity on the police side, which I fear is also stifled. I remember reading about some officer who came upon a teenager being very cruel, killing a swan in a park or something, and instead of taking him through formal processes, he marched him off to a local sort of swan refuge or bird refuge, wildfowl refuge, which he just happened to have about his neighbourhood. And this guy was required to sort of attend there, and he became an absolute fanatic, really interested in it, and it was a life-changing thing. Now, you obviously cannot replicate anything like that, and it's terribly difficult to sort of supervise and manage, but, over some spontaneity in life, both on the offender or potential offender side and on the intervention side.
I took a parliamentary delegation to Italy to have a look at the Italian youth justice system, and they do more or less what you're suggesting. They have a system where people are put, they admit guilt, young children. Of course, their age of criminal responsibility is 14, which is a start in life, so they cannot commit a crime under 14. But they're put on probation, and the magistrates are not lay magistrates, they are experts, so it's a very psychological model. And they're put on probation and told to comply with certain programmes which are individually tailored, and then at the end of this period of time, whatever period of time that is, they go back to these expert magistrates, and there is no conviction. There is no slate to wipe clean. It is gone. And that's with almost all offences. I sat in on a young boy who'd committed quite a serious sex offence, and at 18 it was wiped clean, it was gone, he'd complied, he'd done the treatment, and it was quite intensive, but he'd walked free. Their custody rate of children is 10% of ours. 10%. This is a country with the same population, the same GDP, same mix of population, and they manage in a completely different way. And you wouldn't think it. You wouldn't think that Italy would be in the forefront of penal reform for children, but actually it's a very interesting model. And it's very, very similar, I think, to some of the principles. Obviously, the methodology is slightly different, but it's interesting to have a look at. I just thought I'd, you know, share that with you. Oh, look, we've got lots of hands. Okay. You just choose who you want to, Jenny. She's got the microphone. She's in charge.
I'm Sarah Richardson from MOPAC. I was just interested in knowing a little bit more about what happens if someone doesn't comply, what the process is, and whether compliance is subjective or if there's strict parameters around that.
Thank you.
Hi, my name's Rob Allen. Thanks very much. It was really interesting. Just on the juvenile point, I don't know, Francis, when you went to Italy, but, I mean, the numbers of kids in custody in this country has fallen from about 3,000 to about 1,200 over the last 5 years, and in large part that's because the police are not bringing the cases into courts, and that in large part was because, you know, up until one day, the government were measuring police performance in terms of offences brought to justice, which encouraged them to push cases in, and the next day they decided to actually do the reverse and reward the police's performance or praise the police's performance of keeping kids out of the system. And in some of those youth offending teams, they are actually doing triaging and calling it triaging. So I'm not sure what your claims for this to be entirely new and so on are quite right. And what I would suggest is the obvious point to extend it into is the sort of young adult range. If we're doing it and it seems to be working okay with under 18s, why not concentrate on 19, 20, 21-year-olds as a sort of possible way of extending something that's already, you know, all over the country working with juveniles?
Thank you. At the back. Thank you.
Thank you. My name's Nick McGeorge. I am a forensic psychologist, worked in the prison service. I have two various hats, several hats. One of them is I'm a district criminal court mediator in North Carolina, and I'm a community mediator in Southampton. North Carolina, they have a system where the judge will encourage people to go to mediation. The mediators are sitting in the court, and the people have said whether they'd like to do it or not, they're asked, and they come to a mediation. If they agree an outcome, the victim can come back to the prosecutor and say, the agreement hasn't been kept, therefore I want a trial. And the person going to mediation who's got the offence, hasn't been found guilty, gets the case dismissed, not registered. So they've got an incentive to do it, and the victim feels empowered. I think it's brilliant. The other thing that I'm involved with in Southampton area, we've done a couple of things with the police directly. One of them is going to the persistent neighbour disputes. We resolved all of the ones that they had as persistent. We had a two-year follow-up. None of them came back, and the money ran out. And nobody knows what the actual cost is of doing the call-outs. The other thing I have, which has been asked, is that the judge, the recorder for Southampton, is a patron of the mediation service. And he wanted me to look at the issue of why women don't come to court in domestic violence cases, because he said 50% of the cases, nothing happens. And I've tried working on that, and then discovered from the court administration of Southern England that 50% of the cases going to Crown Court, nothing happens, as they're concerned, and it's 60% for the magistrates. I wonder on occasions what we're running. And I do know a great example in Stoke-on-Trent, which I've been trying to find out more details, where the community rose up against all the crime in their council estate, and they stopped their ward being the main provider for abortion. And it worked. And I think to myself it worked because the community got involved. Well, by the way, as a community mediator in North Carolina, I'm entitled to give up to 15,000 damages, as it were, reparation, to a clinic without anybody checking on me, and the mediation agreements are not checked by the court.
Power, absolute power. I'm going to take everybody else and then ask each of the panel to say any final comments that they want to make. So we, because there's people raising some interesting points. Maybe it, is anybody in there? Anybody else?
Yeah, Mary of Shopnessy. I'm a member of Standing Committee for Youth Justice, and I'm also an employer who employs young offenders. And we actually had a conversation yesterday with the police junior police commissioner in Cheshire. And what we're looking to do is taking those who are 13, 14 and either in the system at the cusp and putting them into roles within, or training them up with roles within the utility sector where they have the excitement factor, but we know that there's definitely a skills shortage coming through. So we're hoping to get our sector skills council involved and actually give them those skills which will, they can see a bigger picture. Part of that will be they'll hopefully be assigned a mentor who is outside the system and can keep on straight and narrow, but working in partnership with the police is something that's very in the early stages. But going back to what you're saying, I think it's about that joined-up approach. Yes, the resources are not there within the police, but there are other organisations within business that would be more than happy to put in the resources because we all want the best for the young people.
Thank you. And Martin there?
Martin Wright, formerly of the Restorative Justice Council. Unless I missed it, I don't think you mentioned the Youth Restorative Disposal, which is another gateway that people could go through. It sounds a bit like the police having a sort of conversation which police traditionally didn't have with young people, and that could be one way forward. As regards admitting guilt, in New Zealand, I believe they have a formula that says that the accused has not to deny what they're accused of. So they don't admit it, but they don't deny it, and then the thing can go ahead. In other words, you haven't got the wrong person, so there's something to negotiate about. And lastly, on conditional caution, you mentioned that they hadn't led to very much restorative justice. A large part of the reason of that is presumably because there wasn't anybody around to deliver it if they wanted to. And if we could have more restorative justice, if there was a network of people qualified to provide it.
Was there anybody else who wants to say or ask? Did you want to? Yes.
Paul Rock, I'm not quite sure what I want to say, but I think it's a footnote to what the other Paul Ekblom was saying. Britain has, or the United England and Wales, had a history of developing what seem to be entirely defensible, rational proposals which meet with political death. And one thinks of the 1991 Act, one thinks of the sad fate of Professor Nutt, who made some, it seemed to me, entirely sensible proposals about assessing risks of drugs. And it goes on. One thinks of the fate of Metropolitan Police Commissioners, who have been excoriated when they talked about phasing response times to various kinds of offence. I just wonder whether you've had any adverse experience in terms of, as it were, the politics of populist red-top reaction to what you're saying, or political. Yeah, often one gets the impression that politicians are quite happy not to do anything, even if it's sensible, for fear of political repercussions. And it sounds to me as if so far you've had a reasonably smooth run, and I hope that continues. I'm just wondering, you know, what your response to that might be.
I'm going to ask Paul and Gloria, and then we can have a last one.
Okay. Right, okay. Well, just in response to Paul's point, I was reading an interesting item in The New Scientist the other day about climate change and these climate change deniers they have, particularly in the States, and the lessons that scientists were learning now, not just to keep hammering home, but these are the facts, that only seems to make the opponents, the deniers, even more resistant. What they're now trying to do is to actually start from the values and the key assumptions about society, etc., that the anti-climate change people are making, and then work them gradually towards the position of shared understanding and shared values. And by the way, you know, the facts happen to say this. You know, there's probably a good PhD or two there to try and sort that one out. But it is an alternative to, you know, spy and cop in the Boer War, where instead of going round it, they tried to go up it and sort of slam into each other's guns and whatever.
Just a general comment. I think I've been kind of struck by many of the speakers have come up with other ideas. How about this? How about that? And I think this leaves me thinking there's an awful lot of creativity out there, an awful lot of ideas out there for various reasons aren't picked up. One of those reasons, I think, comes back to politics, and one of the many reasons I left the Home Office in 1990, whatever it was after serious frustration with the umpteenth minister and having to explain for the umpteenth time about something, thinking I can't do this anymore. One of the reasons I think that they don't listen to the rational argument is because they want to be re-elected, and there's nothing irrational about that. And if we want to get our ideas, including what works and the evidence-based stuff, going, we've got to get much better at pulling levers over politicians. At one point I thought I just despair of democracy, but setting that radical notion aside, they're conscious of cost, they're conscious of precedent, they're totally conscious of the media, they're conscious of their constituents, all these things, and lobby groups are pressuring them to do something else. And I could wax lyrical on the ridiculous alcohol policy we have in this country. Very different just about everywhere, including Italy. Lots of young people get into trouble because of alcohol. They don't have that in Italy at all. Well, they do, but it's not at all in the same sense. And that's because we've got a £19 billion drinks industry. So until we can learn how to get levers over politicians and push them in a more rational direction, we might end up still having these conversations in another 20 years' time.
Well, that's cheerful. Thank you. Sorry. Peter, last word.
Okay, it's interesting that we've ended up praising Italy, the land of Berlusconi. And having actually spent a day with the Italian police, yeah, it's an intriguing organisation, let's put it like that. Paul, I think the politics are important of this. I mean, it's actually fortuitous that it's West Midlands, and Bob Jones is the Policing and Crime Commissioner, who's the one who rather delightfully supported the paper that a number of us were involved in, and which involved abolishing his office. So he's a kind of irrational, rational politician in those terms, but also thoroughly committed to finding better solutions for victims. And as this seems to offer a potentially better solution for victims, he's been very supportive and got a very early briefing on it as he came in, because that was one of the risks in the project. And given it's Birmingham and it's big enough, we haven't made a secret of it. We've just got on with it, and maybe we've been lucky because we haven't had any really, really tetchy cases. Actually, I think the process of having the PCCs in place and all the other turmoil, there are plenty of other things to pay attention to at the moment. So it's been an excellent couple of years, because there's been so much not so good stuff flying around, to be honest, to be able to get on with something innovative. But it also comes back to the question about compliance. It's actually really important that we can demonstrate that it is pretty tight. In fact, it's very tight. The cops, I think, in general, have a slightly lower threshold of non-compliance than probation officers in those terms. So it's been, in some ways, probably less discretionary than almost every other aspect of it. If they don't comply, they don't comply, and they get breached. Which probably means that if you were comparing this to most other treatments, probably the breach rate is going to look a bit high, but that I think is because I'm doing some comparison to the conditional cautions where the breach rate is very low, but I don't think anyone is doing any supervision of them. In fact, no, I don't think, I know that nobody is doing any supervision of them. They don't think it's a fair comparison. This one is getting very high levels of treatment in that sense. Rob, we have got adults and juveniles in this, so we are definitely including young adults. In fact, there are more adults than juveniles in the trial process. I've also looked at the triaging that's supposedly been done in other places. Nobody can produce me, and if anyone here knows of one, but nobody can produce me a decent evaluation report or indeed a decent description of what the triaging is. And I think unless you can produce a decent description of what it is, I don't believe you're doing it. And I have spoken to a whole variety of people and emailed varieties of people who've claimed that they're doing it, and I've had emails that haven't been returned. So all I can say is, if they are doing it, they're not doing it in a way where they can demonstrate it and hold it out to me, and therefore I don't believe it. And it's interesting that you've mentioned mediation, because that's another potential partner, another potential tactic and strategy that we could use in the process. But there is, incidentally, you've talked about persistent neighbourhood disputes. There is an evaluation randomised control trial in Birmingham that's about to be published on persistent neighbourhood disputes using various forms of problem solving and mediation. So back to Gloria's point about problem solving, looks promising, as most problem solving now does increasingly in the RCTs. Which I know is one of the issues. Well, yeah, it does. Looks very promising. Demonstrably proved as to be promising. And there was never any doubt. One of the things we want to test is DV cases, domestic violence cases. But it's been challenging to put Turning Point, and that is the territory where we decided we wouldn't put domestic violence or hate crime into the process, because we were fairly certain that we would end up in difficulties. But now that we've got an established process, there is considerable warmth to testing domestic violence with this technique. It's just that it requires a distinct, it's a separate trial. I would need fresh cash to do it for a start. And I can't stretch myself much further with all the other stuff I'm doing to be able to do this either. And I have incidentally learnt the importance of a field experimental assistant. So I would never, ever do one of these without a full-time field experimental assistant, because this is one of those things that needs constant nurturing, back to the Webb's lettuce that was mentioned. I suppose the final piece there, you know, there are a whole host of tactics in this. I would say that most of the practitioners in this system know only about a third of the things that they could potentially use, because the system has become so complicated with the laid over. I mean, just the pre-court disposals, there's about seven of them. Very few of them have been properly researched. Very few practitioners fully understand all of the elements of them. There are too many for most practitioners, and it really needs to be simplified. I mean, if there's one thing that does come out of Grayling's review that he's triggered off, and I'm not sure that he's doing it for this purpose at all, but if there's one thing that might come out of it, actually, it is that given that we've got a National College of Policing, given that we've potentially got a Probation Institute as well, there is a potential for those two organisations to produce some decent standards for practice and simplify the field down to the things where there's a really decent prospect of what you do working. And I suppose my sort of final point is that, Gloria, I don't agree with you that austerity means these things can't be done. The police service has still got, and if I begin to sound like a Labour politician at this point, I probably am. The police service has still got a £10-11 billion budget. There is still an awful lot of policing going on out there. The policing should not simply revert to doing reactive 999 response. And I know Rob very nicely said in one of the early ones that that is a very important part, and I agree with Robert entirely. But it can't be the sole method, and even in doing 999, problem solving should be part of that. The police service is always going to be arresting people, because that's again part of what they do, and they ought to be doing that better, because even with reducing resources, you should be trying to make maximum use of it. So I don't think that's an argument for not taking techniques like this. In fact, I think it can often be used by colleagues as an excuse, when a great deal of what they do is poor practice, which is unevidenced and is basically wasting resources doing nugatory things that don't add value. Here ended the lesson.
Well, I think it's been absolutely fascinating, and there's a lot to think about. I hope we're going to persuade Peter to write it up, and we'll publish a pamphlet and have a parliamentary event, and he'll get what he wants by the practice we've got so far, we hope. Maybe. Thank you very much for coming and for your comments and your participation. We will have future events like this. and we will keep you in touch. And meanwhile, do please fill in the membership forms. But thank you very much. Thank you to our speakers. It's fantastic.